Wish I'd forget you, but you're here to stay. It seems I met you when my love went away. Now every day I start by saying to you, good morning, heartache, what's new?
Well, welcome to After Hours with me, Rick Cogan. That gal could sing. My father was ever in love with Billie Holiday, who he would visit at a variety of clubs around Chicago, including a club called Mr. Kelly's. I am always thrilled to have my friends. I'm going to call you two fellas great entrepreneurs, Daryl Nitz and David Marienthal, and two of the greatest performers in this town or anywhere, Suzanne Petrie and Ann Burnell. Hi.
Hi.
Hello.
Hi.
You all admirers of Billie Holiday, too, are you?
God, yes.
Mm-hmm. Monday night, you are going, David Marienthal, this is, again, your idea in collaboration with Daryl and in collaboration with Suzanne and Anne and other local songbirds. You don't mind the phrase songbirds, do you?
No.
You two, of all the women I know, would go, wow, we love that. Yeah. Rick, we're so offended. How can you call it songbirds? There's going to be at City Winery a tribute to the women of Mr. Kelly's. David, how'd you get this idea?
Well, Daryl and I have had two other phenomenal successful shows at City Winery where we featured Sarah Vaughan and the albums that she recorded at Mr. Kelly's in London House, and Ella Fitzgerald's seminal recording of 58 that was recorded at Mr. Kelly's. And so it was really at Daryl's suggestion that we came up with the idea of doing a review of all the great women performed at Mr. Kelly's.
Daryl, in going through the records, mm-hmm. do you have any idea how many female performers sang there?
No, not, I mean, but I went through the years from 54 up to like 75. Like Mimi Hines was one of the last women to perform there, which is so crazy. And Captain and Tennille in 75 as well.
Wow.
And I poured through it, looking through anybody that had, you know, even like somebody like Jerry Southern or Maya Angelou, just anybody with any kind of name recognition. And then what I did was assemble a cast and say, okay, here's some of the people that performed, and who are you, you know, most interested in? So like Judy Roberts, she's going to do something from Anita O'Day's album that was recorded there, and it's actually Anita O'Day's 100th anniversary.
Well, and Judy, who looks nowhere near old enough to have actually been around there, as neither do I, and I was around there. Judy performed at the London House.
She literally was a kid.
Judy was
at London House and Mr. Kelly.
London House and Kelly.
Yeah, she's doing a gig tonight and wasn't able to be here, and she was sorry.
Okay.
Even at nighttime, we could have got her.
See, that's what it's a nice thing to even have a gig anytime, especially on a Sunday night. How many performers did you select?
So I have, I think it's 8 and myself.
Wow. And who are you going to be, Barbara Streisand? What are you doing?
Well,
actually, listen to that voice. Toadie Fields.
No,
I'm doing Toadie Fields.
The lady that you just heard. We just did a show the other night. I did Billie Holiday singing.
Have you heard his Billie Holiday?
I certainly have not.
I certainly have not.
Well.
Can you sing a couple bars?
Them that's got shall get, them that's not shall lose. So the Bible says, and it still is news.
I'll buy it.
Yes, Daryl.
Wow. How long have you been doing Billie Holiday?
Oh, my gosh.
Since I was a child.
Yeah. I've been doing a long time. I started as a vocal impressionist, a singer, like under Pudgy Cardella.
Sure.
That was kind of my thing, was this singing impressionist, you know, and she would put me in some of her gigs. And so the other woman that I'm paying tribute to is Eartha Kitt.
Wow.
Those are my...
So, Suzanne Petrie, Daryl calls you and he says, hey, as he has probably called you 150 times, says, hey, I have an idea for you.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and he gave me four ideas of four women to do. And I started listening to Kay Ballard, who I love and adore, and Judy Hensky, totally the other way, who I also do and would love to do some of hers. And, of course, Julie Wilson, who I do.
Sure.
Who I love and knew. And we all had so much influence by Julie. And then Dorothy Loudon, who was a great Broadway star. And I saw her in Sweeney Todd. And...
Go ahead.
And anyway, just looking around at these, I just couldn't decide. But I finally ended up doing one that, of course, Julie Wilson and then Dorothy Loudon. And it turns out it's a song that Anne has done. Anne and Daryl did it the last show. But I'm doing it anyway. I'm going to make it my own.
One of the great things about this show, Monday at City Winery, is it's not only is it going to evoke memories for some people there, it is also going to introduce people to singers they might not ordinarily have heard. And don't you agree? And what did you say when Daryl called? Not again. Daryl puts on a lot of shows in this town, and he has worked with virtually every singer in the Chicago area.
My answer to Daryl is always, I will do anything for you. Mm-hmm. And his answer to me is hopefully the same. So
absolutely.
We have that mutual thing. Yep. We can call each other in the middle of the night.
So how did he put this to you? We're doing it. It's a, you know.
He said, you know, we're doing, I'm doing another show with David Marienthal, and it's going to be the Women of Mr. Kelly's, and who would you like to do? And he gave me some ideas, and I said, but Julie London was there too.
And
he
and she wasn't on the list.
She wasn't on the list. And so we added her to the list.
Oh, and you're doing Julie
my favorite.
London.
Yeah,
one of mine too.
I'm doing one of her songs, and Mama Cass, very underrated.
See, that's something that a lot of people don't realize either. I mean, David Marienthal brought in some albums that were recorded live at Mr. Kelly's. I had no idea that the Mamas and the Papas performed.
Well, it was just her. It was her.
She was the Mama.
Solo career.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting with all these women. There is really a wide range of styles, you know.
Oh,
so
no
you
question.
Have the cabaret type people and Broadway people, you have jazz, and then you have pop.
Yeah.
And it really covers
and folk.
And Judy Hensky was folk, you know.
Oh, yeah.
And
I think this is what you have with the span of Mr. Kelly's opening in 1953 and closing in 1975. And my uncle Oscar and my father George just had this eye on what was the talent of mid-century America.
We got to take a break, but you guys are going to be on the entire hour, and maybe we can have Daryl do another Billie Holiday.
Or Eartha Kitt.
I'm so taken with this, it's not even funny. We'll be back in a couple minutes. For more than 20 years, a variety of singers, female singers, Billie Holiday, Ella Fitzgerald, Sarah Vaughan, Helen Reddy, the Pointer Sisters, Natalie Cole, Bette Midler, Mama Cass Elliott performed at Mr. Kelly's, which was where? On the corner where Gibson's now sits at Rush and Bellevue. It was among certainly the most famous nightclub in Chicago in its time and in the top three nightclubs across the country. There's a great piece in the Tribune. I don't know whether it's today, you know, who knows how this. I'm an old paper guy. It could be today's paper. It could have been Friday's paper by Howard Reich, interviewing Barbara Streisand, who now plays much bigger halls than Mr. Kelly's. But she recalled her first time coming to Chicago, and she recalled vividly performing at Mr. Kelly's and how much she loved Chicago immediately, and how she convinced, as David Marienthal, one of my guests, certainly remembers, she convinced the photographer who was shooting her for her first album cover to go walk over to Oak Street Beach and shoot it there. And how her record company hated the photographs that were taken on the beach because it was sort of Barbara looking over her shoulder. And that album cover at some point won some special Grammy Award for greatest album cover of the 60s or something. Who's doing Barbara Streisand at your show?
Denise Thomas. Yeah. I'm sorry. The Denise Tomasello, Queen of Cabaret. Denise. I'm saying Denise Tomasello.
Oh, she's
in case she's listening.
Denise has to be listening.
She's listening.
How did you select, Daryl, when you put this together, and obviously in collaboration with David and with Suzanne Petrie and Ann Burnell, when you put together a show like this, you want to create, I think, a kind of song narrative where it's not just a bunch of your songs thrown together in the way that you two ladies once created those wonderful things called albums and CDs. How do you do that?
Well, really what I try to do is to focus on the music and let the music tell the story. So mm-hmm. I honestly keep my narratives very brief, even with the Sarah Vaughan and the Ella Fitzgerald, because I want to get in as many songs as possible. I hire and, you know, cast people who I know are going to deliver for me, and they'll talk about the people as they want to and say what they need to say, and they won't say too much or too
little. I don't mean any sort of spoken narrative. What I mean is the way in which songs follow one another.
Oh, sure.
Is it done? I mean, one way to do it would be conceivably chronologically.
Right.
That's not the best way.
No, it's not the best way, but in this show, I did mostly the jazz up front.
Okay.
And then I did the pop and the... Well, the pop, you know, with Barbara Streisand and Bette Midler sort of at the end, you know.
We're doing a Broadway bunch of sisters.
Yeah, we did some Broadway in there.
How many songs are going to be heard at this City Winery concert?
There's going to be 18, 19.
David, what part do you play in this, David Marienthal?
Well, I'm... We've been working on a film about Mr. Kelly's for the last 4 years.
Yes, as listeners to this show are well aware.
My goal when I started this project 4 years ago was to create this archive of material that creative people, artists, singers could draw on to make, you know, to really bring back Mr. Kelly's in life. And, you know, that's by, you know, really researching all these, you know, dozens and dozens of performers that did that. We really gave Daryl and the other artists the opportunity to, you know, create this original, really original show.
And as the youngster of this crowd, what did you know about Mr. Kelly's before getting involved in any of this or hearing about David's documentary? Yeah. Was it a kind of a legend? I mean,
yeah,
you
it was
hear
legendary.
From,
like you the must old have, cats that I would play with, the jazz guys, they would say, oh, you should have been here when the London House was happening and Mr. Kelly's, that was always, they always told me about that. You know, so I was very curious.
So it was kind of like, you know, sort of Camelot-like to you,
mm-hmm,
right?
Mm-hmm. Right? A scene that was really cool.
Suzanne,
happening.
You too, I assume.
Yeah, and because I moved here, I was just a wee child.
You were.
In 1976, I was, you know, 3 or 4, and I was singing at the Domino Lounge. And my boss there, Danny Miller, told me, you just missed Mr. Kelly's. And he would tell me everything about it. And
you have to sit here and listen to Frank Penning.
Oh. But first, Danny did the jokes.
Oh, I know.
That's what I heard first. Yeah. And then I was like, oh, my God. And then Frank came in. Well, he had another... Well,
It pleased the conventioneer.
Oh boy, did it ever! Did it ever? And they brought in their own jokes.
But you two women, ladies, are more than aware of that kind of historical legacy of not just Kelly's in the London House, which was also owned by the Marienthal brothers, and the Happy Medium, which was also owned by the Marienthal brothers, but of the legendary clubs and the legendary scene here. It's not something that weighs on you as performers, but it's something you, I've seen both of you perform a number of them, it's something you kind of acknowledge. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
That the past is kind of, in a sense, history is the past relating to the present.
Right, it informs us now, and all the music that they sang is the music that I love. I know that we love. We love to sing. And I came here from Minneapolis where I sang in clubs, or I would go to New York and sing in piano bars. And with the chance that I got to come here to Chicago and just go around and see all these fabulous performances in these great clubs. Even then, most of the great clubs were closed. But there were great clubs.
Oh, no question. And I think, you know, and keeping that alive is, you know, I've been talking to David Marienthal about this when he first came back.
Well, I think
Chicago.
We have to give a shout out to City Winery. I mean, this is a great venue. They have great food. Every seat is a good seat. We have a few left. So.
But, you know, I have to give a shout out to whoever it was who thought that David and Daryl should get together. And
that was me.
We got to take a break.
The idiot entrepreneur, the idiot impresario. It's one of the only great matches making. We got to get some commercials, then we get some news, and we will continue on talking about not only the legacy of Mr. Kelly's, but the sort of real rebirth of it. We'll be right back.
Better go now, because I like you much too much. You have a way with you. You'd better go now, because I like you very much. The night was gay with you.
I hate to tell you, that is not Daryl Nitz. That is Billie Holiday. From one of the legendary performers from the legendary club, Mr. Kelly's, that is being celebrated. It's not being remembered. It's being celebrated tomorrow night at the City Winery in a concert that features two of my guests and two of my dear friends, Ann Burnell and Suzanne Petrie. Who else, Daryl Nitz? You are in it. You gave us a sample of Billie Holiday earlier. Who else did you recruit for this?
So Frida Lee, she's doing Ella Fitzgerald and Sarah Vaughan, and Holly McGuire. She's doing Dinah Washington and Nancy Wilson. Mm. And then Judy Roberts is paying tribute to Anita O'Day and doing a little bit to some of the women at the London House, Barbara Carroll. But she's also going to pay tribute to Audrey Morris. And then LaShira Moore is doing Della Reese, which she actually did an album there at Mr. Kelly's. And Natalie Cole is LaShira Moore. And Michelle Thomas is doing Carmen McRae. And again, it's I let the singers try to choose what they're drawn to. And so she chose Ethel Ennis. And you don't
I don't know who that is.
Oh, she... she's like...
Etta Jones.
Etta Jones.
She's got a really rough, powerful voice.
And then Morgana King and Dionne Warwick is Margaret Murphy Webb.
Wow.
And then Denise Tomasello.
Yes, she's Barbara
Streisand. Denise Tomasello is Bette Midler and Barbara Streisand.
Oh, hard to believe.
And there were the Pointer Sisters played there too, so we're going to close it with a fun Pointer Sisters number. So.
And you will, I'm assuming, during the performance. I'm sure Judy will talk about her time there, because she actually did play there. And in some interviews I've done with that lovely woman over the years, she's just, you could not, David Marienthal, be fonder of your father and your uncle.
No, Judy is a great example of one of the many talented women that were really nurtured in these places. And I guess I have to just, you know, when Daryl came up with the idea of the women of Mr. Kelly's, it was just so perfect, because there were so many women that were so important to the success of the business. Mm-hmm. It wasn't only these, you know, great performers, but it was people like Arlene Rothberg, who was discovered that went to New York for my father and came back with the Smothers Brothers, Woody Allen, and Barbara Streisand.
He put him in a car? Said, look who I got for you. He's a pretty talented car.
He was pleased.
Yeah.
And, you know, and then it was, you know, the women that ran the dining room. The dining room manager for 20 years, Estelle, managed the dining room.
Wow.
It was two waitresses that we interviewed that, you know, that were there for 20 or 30 years.
How old were you, David, when you realized what your father and uncle did for a living?
I was 5 years old. As soon as I knew, I mean, I knew that they were a big deal, and I knew they were going downtown, and that people recognized them on the streets and wanted to get in. I mean, this was back when I think local celebrity really was, you know, was more recognized. It was just smaller town, and it was more local. And of course, you know, not only the great women, these women that were involved in the business, right? We have my mother, Jean, sure. Jean Marienthal, sure. and Oscar's wife, Jerry, that, you know, that were instrumental in the business.
Ran from roughly 1954 to 1975 with shows virtually every night and one or two shows every night. Sometimes it would be a comic opening for a singer, or sometimes a singer opening for, you know, Bob Newhart. You have gone out, you show, and you will be showing at City Winery, and Daryl, very momentarily I'm going to ask you to tell people how to get tickets, but you have created, as part of this documentary, what you call a sizzle roll that will give people, and you'll show it Monday night, a taste of the upcoming documentary that's going
right,
to be
we'll
finished
we'll have a taste of all our
interviews.
Of all our interviews, including one of our latest women, which was Lily Tomlin. We got back from interviewing her last year in L.A., and she told the story, and, you know, talking about women and times of women, of helping bust the law that forbade single women from sitting at the bar in early 70s.
That's right.
Yeah.
And so, you know, again, we're featuring the singers of Mr. Kelly's at this point, but the great...
But there's a bigger...
the great women comics that came up there. Joan Rivers, Lily Tomlin, Toadie Fields. I mean, these were, you know, groundbreaking
But it was also, you know, Suzanne Petrie and Anne Burnell, you know, it has never been easy for women in nightclubs anywhere in this country. No, I'm serious.
No, yeah.
Maybe even worse in the comedy scene, because there were fewer of the fairer sex.
And this is an interracial club. They had no... You guys were one of the first people to have...
It was. You know, George and Oscar really, you know, made a concerted effort to welcome, you know, people of all races, both in terms of...
Very diverse.
Their
yeah.
staff.
Which was, and I know it's hard for some of you out there, to believe, but believe it. That's the way Chicago was in the 50s.
It is really hard to believe. I know that later on, and I worked at the Underground Wonder Bar, I always felt that it was a microcosm of Chicago, because it was also very interracial, and a woman could go in there and sit at the bar. And I've got friends who always told me that. It's like, I never felt uncomfortable.
Yeah.
But that was in the 80s.
Right.
So when you go into the 70s, and I remember my boss, Danny Miller, would say, you can't have a man buy you a drink because then you're a B-girl.
Yeah, right, sure.
Yeah.
Because there were, you know, those kinds of clubs on Rush Street.
Oh, yes.
There were.
But that was, yeah, so earlier they...
So I hope, I mean, I, you know, Judy will tell some stories, but Daryl, you too, I think that is something to punctuate this evening of song that you're going to have. How can people get tickets? There aren't many left. How can they
Great.
Get them?
So you can go to City Winery, and you have to choose Chicago. So City Winery, Chicago, and then it's, because the show is tomorrow, it's like
the
first or
thing
second thing, yeah, that's there. Also, if you just, I'll Google just, you know, Mr. Kelly's women or whatever, it also takes you there. But it's City Winery, Chicago. And we do have a $5 off. The tickets range from $45 to $30, and you can use the code WGN5. I guess that's who we are, the WGN5. That's the five of us. No, but WGN5 will get you $5 off any price point of the tickets if you put it in as a code when you go and purchase it.
What if you put in WGN45?
I'm wearing a shirt that has that spindle that's the 45. That's what I'm wearing tomorrow. Because of all the great recordings, I was like, this is my shirt paying tribute to the great recordings made. And I figure anybody who doesn't know what that...
That's
little.
Neat.
If they don't
you.
Know what that
good
is, then
you.
I shouldn't be dating
We can
them.
Also go to our website.
Send them to the Kelly site.
At www.MrKelly'sChicago.com.
Mm-hmm. And you can get a lot of stuff there.
Right there. We have a great website with a lot of photos of Kelly's, a lot of great blog posts about
some
Richard
video,
Pryor.
Too. Some video.
Some videos, a link to the trailer of the film. And you can go, that'll take you right to City Winery. Where
do you have it on your Facebook?
And we do want to mention, too, that we don't, there's a few seats left in the front section and several in the back, but you want to, you know, get on there quick because we really don't have.
Go tonight.
Yeah, there's not very many in the front at all.
Many people aren't listening to the show are sleeping, so beat them to the punch. I'm going to ask when we come back from a quick commercial break, you two are. Suzanne Petrie and Ann Burnell among the most stylish people I know, and I know that part of you two are you two, Daryl.
You're
not a performer,
perhaps,
but part of performance is the way you look. I want to talk about that for a while. We'll be back in a couple minutes.
Here are simply Billie Holiday and Friends, and I'll see you in a little bit. Thank you.
Say that folks don't criticize me, but I'm going to do.
That is Dot Daryl Knits. That is Billie Holiday. The
what I want to anyway.
That's Daryl Knits. You can't even tell the difference.
Not at all.
Absolutely, absolutely no difference. I'm finishing up this lovely hour with David Marienthal, Daryl Knits, Suzanne Petrie, and Ann Burnell. And I was mentioned before the commercial break that you two ladies know how to put on a show. And one element of the cabaret nightclub performance is, of course, vocalese. But there is a lot more going on. I mean, even into the way you dress and the way you move. Could you talk about that for a couple minutes, ladies?
Well, you know, we went to Cabaret Camp, or also known as the Cabaret Symposium at the Eugene O'Neill Theater Center together.
Mm-hmm.
And there were people there that told you to do this and that and the other thing. Well, I brought a suitcase full of gowns. I've always been so thrilled by finding things, and I do a lot of resale shopping. In fact, just the other day I was at the Salvation Army, and I found a real black sequiny pailleted gown that I think I'll wear. But it's always, you know, it's like putting the thing together that goes with the outfit goes with the style of the song that you're singing. So going from Dorothy Loudon to Julie Wilson, well, I'm going to have to bring my boas.
Yeah. What about the gardenia?
Oh, I know, but maybe I will pull my hair back and do the gardenia. Why not? She told me to do that she didn't say the gardenia, but at
Julie Wilson was one of our teachers at that.
She was. Yeah. She was our master teacher, and she came to my show in New York.
You know, there's a very cool story about, she recorded Meet Julie Wilson, and she loved Billie Holiday so much, that's why she did it.
Absolutely.
And she wanted the album to be this tribute to Billie Holiday, but they did not release it at that. And she always felt funny, like, you know, Julie Wilson had some of that same kind of, like, I don't know, like the lift in her voice. Mm-hmm. And there's that Meet Julie Wilson is really sounds so much like Billie Holiday, but she was doing it like as if Billie Holiday sang these songs, and you know, it never got released in the right, you know, way for her, even after they put it out on CD.
There is also, even at a place the size of City Winery, which is a bit larger than was Mr. Kelly's, part of the thing that any performer has to do in a room like that is create, whether in movement, dress, and song, the sense of intimacy that both of you are expert at, Suzanne Petrie and Ann Burnell. I mean, that is important to know that you are connecting with that audience.
That's what cabaret is. Cabaret is speaking intimately to the audience, being there. Like, I'm also a theater
Right,
acting.
Sure.
Yeah, I have an acting
and
background.
And so in theater,
too,
so yeah. You have the proscenium, you have that third wall. And it's so, that's why I've always, my whole life, loved cabaret in the sense of actually being intimate with
We had uncovered as part of our research for the film an unbelievable interview with Eartha Kitt and Studs Terkel.
Oh.
And Eartha Kitt was actually explaining to Studs that exact thing, how you need to get out to the audience. And then in the process, we uncovered a beautiful photograph that shows Eartha Kitt literally going up to one of the patrons and, mm-hmm. you know, holding him in her hand.
I've done that a few times.
Yeah, I'm sure you have.
But see, that to me is what, you know, there's people, whenever we put these shows together, they'll come out of the woodworks going, hey, can we be in your show? I do this or I do that. And the thing is that I call what I do Daryl Mitt's entertainment.
Right.
Because I want to work with people who are entertainers. And right. whether it's jazz, Judy Roberts, I have never seen anyone work a room like she does, sitting there playing the piano, aware of everybody who comes in. And that's what it's about. It's in Denise Tomasello, these people, Frida Lee, they work the room, but they use their music and their gift of communication
to sing
for people, not at people.
Oh, yeah. Well, and also, I think, you know, in this era when the world has become, the ways in which we communicate have become so icy, you know, 140 lettered tweets and an emoji is supposed to, you know, is it dictate your emotions, for Christ's sake. There is something unbelievably rare and special about that kind of gathering.
Well, that's why it's been such an honor for me, and I do have to, you know, thank Daryl and Suzanne and Anne here for, you know, as well as the other performers. It's just been such an honor for me to, you know, to have them recreate and celebrate, as you say, the memory of Kelly's and such talent and such commitment and, you know, and such really interest in what went on.
It's another great thing. Yes, these were all great singers, but it's another thing that sort of underlines the fact that this city is still filled with great, distinctive performers.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It's very true. And in New York, a lot of those people have passed. I mean, we just lost Baby Jane Dexter,
yeah.
and Julie Wilson, yeah. and Bobby Short.
And Audrey Morris, not long ago.
But in New York, they lost a lot of those very distinct personalities. A lot of the cabaret or these nightclubs are Broadway people who are just, you know, yeah. they have a night off from the theater, they're going to do something. And they're great performers, mm-hmm. but they're not the people that, you know, made their living at performing in nightclubs.
Yeah, it's
and
such a
difference.
And we
still have a lot of those people around. I mean, we all have to kind of have our day job to keep afloat.
Yeah, sure.
But we're in the clubs singing for the people, making musical memories, whether it's, you know, Davenport's, or we were at Victory Garden last week, mm-hmm. or Mr., you know, the City Winery, or there's other smaller clubs around, you know.
And they're doing good business. I mean, yeah, I see business increasing.
Chicago.
Yeah, I agree.
We're so happy that we've nearly sold out this show on a Monday night in July.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
A lot of other things going on. Of the performers.
Go to citywinery.com/Chicago, and the first thing that will pop up there will be the way you can get tickets. Or go to Mr. Kelly's...
Chicago.
.com. Mm-hmm. And get some more stuff. You guys, it's an ongoing treat to know you.
Thank you.
Mutual, my friend.
Thank you so much, Rick.
When's the movie coming out, David, do you think? When will the movie be finished?
We are shooting for a fall premiere.
Fantastic.
And hopefully it'll be in Chicago. We're in the final.
Where else could it be?
We have a rough
we're
cut.
We're going to do it in Detroit.
Yeah.
What are you talking about?
That's right. Well, we're waiting.
We'll do it in Galena.
Yeah.
We're waiting to hear from the Chicago Film Festival. So
good.
We'll send good energy there.
Come back on
and,
for that.
We have a great film though, and it's going to be so much fun to bring it to the people of Chicago.
Can't imagine, even just to see Mort Saul being interviewed again.
Oh,
great
boy.
Old dear friend of mine. Thank you all. Best of luck tomorrow night.
Thank you.
We'll take a commercial break, then we'll get some news, and then I will talk about another musician named R. Kelly for a whole hour with Jim DeRogatis. Mm-hmm. Welcome back. Jim DeRogatis is a person I have known and admired for some time. He is a professor at Columbia College. He's also the co-host with my colleague Greg Cott of the syndicated show Sound Opinions, which talks mostly about music I don't listen to, but I still listen to the show because they are both really lively. One of the courses that Jim has taught at Columbia is a course called Journalism as Literature, and I would have to say that his new book, Soulless, The Case Against R. Kelly, one of the most compelling books I have read in as long as I can remember, qualifies as journalism as literature. Jim, I know you're a little under the weather, but I hope that compliment is enough to keep you on the radio for the next hour.
Of course, Rick. For you, anything. And plus, we're going to sound alike.
What? good luck to you. I cannot tell you. I've read the book twice, and the depth of this book, I think a lot of people may think, oh, it's about that guy, R. Kelly, who we heard about or saw on TV or who cried in front of Gayle King. This book is so about Chicago. It is about journalism. It is about courts and cops and the church and the failure, I think, of people to stop a monster. You'll accept that I believe this book to exist on a number of different levels. It is hardly Jim DeRogatis just the, hey, R. Kelly's a bad guy and he did this stuff.
Yeah.
It's just a remarkable piece of work. It began sort of when you arrived at the paper, as you write
the Wednesday before Thanksgiving. Yeah.
No one's in the office. You didn't like to go in the office. You came in and you had a bunch of, you know, the free CDs that they send. And there was a fax paper in the days pre-email. Dear Mr. DeRogatis, I'm sending this to you because I don't know where else to go. You wrote about R. Kelly a couple of weeks ago and compared him to Marvin Gaye. Well, I guess Marvin Gaye had problems too, but I don't think they were like Robert's problem. And it's a thing that goes back many years is young girls. You had heard that kind of whisper on the scene, had you not?
Everybody in Chicago had, especially in the music world. You know, from the beginning of Kelly's career, 1990, 1991, it was always in air quotes, Rick.
Mm-hmm.
Robert likes them young. What does that mean? And what does that mean in a field like popular music, where everybody from Frank Sinatra, you know, to the 75-year-old Rolling Stones,
sure,
right?
Sure.
You know, but there was something that had happened in 1994. He produced the debut album by an incredible talent from Detroit, Aaliyah,
mm-hmm.
who was enrolled at the Detroit School of Performing Arts. You know, she was 15, according to her record company bio.
Right.
Other people were whispering, now she was 18. There was a Cook County marriage certificate signed by David Orr, the Cook County clerk, authenticated. She signed it as an 18-year-old, but she was really 15. That went away. When you think that in the late 50s, Jerry Lee Lewis married his 14-year-old second cousin.
Mm-hmm.
It was his third marriage,
yeah,
by the way.
Sure.
You know, and it lasted 2 decades, you know.
Well, there is Jim.
It destroyed his career, you know. But Kelly dodged that bullet with Aaliyah.
Well, it becomes, I think, and you make such good points in the book about this, is fame and certainly money tend to overshadow or get this kind of general, you know, the sins tend to be forgiven. And especially in his case, because he became kind of symbolic to the black community here because he stayed here when he became famous, right?
Right.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, he was a huge hero. You know, you were saying before, journalism is literature. I grew up worshiping this idea of new journalism, Tom Wolfe and The Right Stuff and The Electric Kool-Aid Acid Test, Joan Didion, what Truman Capote had done with In Cold Blood. And it's a horrifying story. It's one that got its teeth into me, and it's been 19 years. I never stopped because when the phone rings and a young woman is saying, I've been hurt, no one will listen to me. Can I tell you my story? I don't think you're a journalist, much less a human being.
You're not a human being. That's why.
I think that the reason to write the book, which I never wanted to write,
I know,
is what does this say about the Me Too moment? What does it say about this city that we love, but also occasionally, more than occasionally, hate?
Yeah.
You know, the race, the music industry, this insidious curse of our time.
Yeah.
You know, look at the White House. You know, all you have to do is be a celebrity, be in the spotlight. You can spout anything, do anything, and the great American disease of the moment is this lust for fame, and people let celebrities get away with anything.
Well, and I think, you know, the other thing about it, and you just mentioned the whole Me Too movement, and the most, you know, famous author of the Me Too movement, Harvey Weinstein. You know, you make the great point you make in this book as well. And again, the book is Soulless, A Case Against R. Kelly, 20 years in the making, and I cannot imagine the energy in the writing. Is that if any one of Robert Sylvester Kelly's victims had been a white kid from Wheaton, this would have been vastly different. I mean, that's a hard thing to face, but it is an absolute truth. Do you agree?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, and it is me repeating what dozens and dozens of black women and men have said. You know, I mean, our job as journalists and broadcasters, you and me, is to give a megaphone to those people who are not being heard. And, you know, they have said to me, and I have simply repeated it, nobody matters less in our society than young black girls. His victims were invisible. And yet, what was astounding, Rick, from the beginning, when I started reporting with Abdon Palish, who was the court's reporter, in the fall of 2000, you know, 3 out of 4 African-American women we met on the West Side or the South Side told us a story of this guy cruising Whitney Young High School, Kenwood Academy, the Rock and Roll McDonald's on Clark Street, Evergreen Plaza Shopping Mall. You know, and if it wasn't firsthand, it was their cousin, their auntie, their sister, their best friend, their teammate on the basketball team. It is now, I would say, literally 4 out of 4, black women. I mean, I've gone and done TV interviews and radio interviews, and the producer will say, I saw him, I had a story, he was at this nightclub, my friend disappeared, or the security guard, or I'm stopped on the street. It was never a secret. This was a monster in the midst of the black community, but black men of power and influence, the Reverend Jesse Jackson, the Reverend James Meeks, the Black Congressional Caucus booked him to do a fundraiser. He was named Grand Marshal of the Bud Billiken Parade, you know, 5 or 6 years after he was acquitted on making child pornography. You know, no one wanted to believe their sisters, their aunts, their wives.
Well, you talk
daughters.
About, you know, one of the concepts, and I hope you can stand. If you really feel bad, you can
call up.
We got to take like some commercial breaks, but I want to talk. You talk about the. I want to right after this commercial. I want to talk about R. Kelly's life, which I think one thing that has been kind of ignored in many of the quick interviews you've had in print and in on television. There have been a number of them. Some have been quite good, but they've been short. Is, you know, you tell me, I'm a Chicagoan, you give me such an accurate and in some ways haunting portrait of who this guy was. Where, I could go on the street right now and ask 100 people where R. Kelly came from and what his childhood was like, and not one of them would be able to tell me. You do a remarkable job of detailing that. I want to talk about that, if you would, when we come back from a short commercial break. I'm talking with Jim DeRogatis, the author of Soulless, The Case Against R. Kelly. It is dedicated, marvelously, it is dedicated for the girls. We'll be back in a couple minutes. I have in front of me a heavily underlined and noted copy of Soulless, The Case Against R. Kelly. I will take the little note out of it after this radio show. I am interviewing the author of this remarkable book, Jim DeRogatis, who has spent 19 years since getting a fax at the office telling him there was something wrong with this R. Kelly. Before we get into the background in R. Kelly's life, which in many ways, Jim, I'll be really honest with you, the way it parts of his background make me almost sad. I'll just tell you that. You do not paint him as a born monster, but a man who became, I think, a monster. You only met him once, in person, once in January 1995. Mm-hmm. And then a while later, you talked at length, 8 months later, and there's some, you quote him, and this paragraph is haunting to me. You write, Jim DeRogatis does, as we were wrapping up, Kelly told me he'd enjoyed our conversation and he wanted to add one more thing. Quote, "This is called show business. What I do in my music is what I feel, not necessarily how I am. I don't walk around with my pants down all day saying, 'Give me a girl.' People need not to judge what they see on TV. Nobody knows Robert," and that's amazing, he always talked in the third person, "or what he's been through. Not R. Kelly, but Robert R. Kelly is a thing on TV." Okay. You do an amazing job of detailing who this kid was. Who was this kid who grew up to be famous and monstrous?
Yeah, you know, I mean, he's a kid from the South Side with everything that's great about the South Side. Mm-hmm. Extended family, you know, basketball games, backyard barbecues. He has the breaks. He gets to go to Kenwood Academy.
Yep.
There was also a lot of horror in those houses where he lived. There was sexual abuse by an older member of the family. His half-brother, Carrie Kelly, has since said it was their older sister. There were four siblings, three boys and a girl. They were all of different fathers. Mm. You know, there's also abuse by an older man, either an actual relative or somebody that they called uncle. You know, Kelly writes about some of this in his autobiography, immodestly titled Solo Coaster, My Diary of Me.
And which, and when you first mentioned that book, you mentioned one of your great inspirations, the great critic Lester Bangs, who told you at one point, rock and roll comes down to myth. There are no facts. And then you write, from the beginning, Kelly excelled at building the myth. You know, you talk about the book by David, co-authored, I suppose, but David Ritz, who's written 36 Told to Celebrities, and a good one about Marvin Gaye. But this book is to be looked at with great suspicion, I would have to say.
I mean, there's buildings that don't exist, addresses that don't exist, streets that don't intersect. He seems to have simply let his tape recorder run.
Yeah.
There was no reporting, no fact-checking. In fact, Ritz brags about that. He says, "My role is to just tell the artist's story the way they want to tell it. And when it's as complicated as R. Kelly's, you are obviously missing 9/10 of the story." You know, the man who was a victim became a victimizer.
Absolutely.
And all of the mental health professionals I've talked to, the experts on sexual abuse, have said that many victims grow up to become champions of other victims trying to stop this, and some become victimizers themselves. I hate armchair psychology.
I know.
The people that I interviewed are people who work with sexual abuse in young black girls in Chicago, one of whom, Dr. Charmaine Jake Matthews, went to high school with Kelly, Kenwood Academy. Mm-hmm. He made 1 year before he was kicked out for the inability to read or write. Another, Dr. Sharon Cooper, was set to testify at his trial. She's a brilliant African-American from the South who travels the world, really the world's foremost authority on sexual abuse of minors. And Judge Vincent Gaughan, during that trial in 2008.
Oh, there's a guy we have to talk about. Yeah.
Yeah, he's a piece of work. I mean, there's a special place in hell for that man.
Yep.
And I feel incredibly vindicated 2 weeks ago Thursday, you know, in black and white, in the federal indictments, 18 new charges from the Southern District of New York and the Northern District of Illinois. The feds have got him. He's never going to breathe fresh air again. You know, he bribed the girl in the videotape in the 2008 trial, her mother and her father, the witnesses who couldn't be bribed to lie to the grand jury or lie in their court testimony or refuse to testify, were threatened physically. And there it is now in black and white. It reads, Rick, you know, I'm a student of pop music. I'm a critic. I'm a historian. Never in the history of popular music, which has a century of men mistreating women.
No question.
Has anybody been hit with criminal charges so extensive? Nobody.
Let me ask you about when you and Abdon, you were paired with Abdon, the bright editor, Don Hainer, among them at the Sun-Times, said, look, this is maybe bigger than music. And you and Abdon, who form one of the most unlikely, but to my mind, one of the cutest pairs of reporters I've ever known. I know and respect Abdon tremendously. What was that like? You were getting into territory, and I don't just mean the physical territory. I mean the legal territory that was unfamiliar to you, and both of you were getting into parts of town that many or most white reporters never go to. You were attempting to get interviews. You were attempting to get the goods on this guy. How was that for you? It must have been a comfort for both of you to have one another. Yes.
Yeah. I mean, it's always an asset to work as part of a team. I think an asset we had as white reporters is we were not afraid to ask stupid questions.
Exactly, exactly.
You know, what do you mean by that?
Sure.
You know, we were clearly not part of these people's communities. On the other hand, as a music critic, you know, there's this instant bonding. You know, a woman is playing who's about to talk about the harm done to someone she loves, you know, her daughter, is playing Mavis Staples. I've interviewed Mavis Staples. You've interviewed Mavis. Suddenly we're cousins, right?
Right.
You know,
right.
I had that ability. Abdon had the, you know, slow, methodical, legal affairs reporter mentality. But I'll tell you, Rick, with one notable exception, and that's a fascinating story, there was no one who slammed their door in our face. We were invited into people's living rooms. We were given tea. We had people crying on our shoulders, showing us literally the scars on their wrists from where they tried to kill themselves after sexual contact with Kelly that began at age 15, ends at age 18. We've wanted to tell our story. No one has been willing to listen.
I guess the two
exceptions were the girl in the videotape, and now we know why.
Right.
It's in black and white, federal indictment. She was paid off. That makes it sound benign. The most horrifying testimony during the trial was an assistant of Kelly's said he would see the mother and the father bring their 14-year-old daughter to R. Kelly's studio with an overnight bag
yeah.
and a pillow.
And pajamas and a pillow.
And leave her for the night.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, she was pipped out. And then there was, I believe, another underage victim that's not named. There are 10 underage victims between the two indictments from the federal courts in New York and Chicago. I believe one is a relative of the girl in the videotape who was a year younger. And we did ring that doorbell, and it was a really impressive mansion in a South Side suburb.
Yep.
And the language that came from that father, but 99% of the doorbells we rang, people wanted to tell this story. And the most common thing we heard was not, I hate that SOB. It was again and again and again. Brother needs help.
Yeah,
brother's got to stop.
Yeah.
He's got a problem.
That haunts me,
too. And, you know, people admired that from this tough upbringing, and that wasn't clear until years later,
right,
the sexual abuse. But from this tough upbringing, he can't read, he can't write. He's busking on the L platforms and in the Viagra Triangle,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
Busking for change. He becomes the dominant voice in R&B of two generations.
Yeah.
You know, he has outsold every artist Chicago has ever produced. You name them. Curtis Mayfield or the Smashing Pumpkins.
And I'll tell you, and even so, Jim, even at the time, another point you bring up remarkably in this soulless case against R. Kelly, for a large time, 90% of Chicago wouldn't have recognized him if he walked down the street. We got to take
a
break.
He was a black superstar, yeah.
Yeah, but that again is one of the fascinating elements of your book. I mean, you make the point that Michael Jordan and Oprah Winfrey had sort of crossed over and being African-American to some other kind of realm. We got to take a commercial break. I hope you have a cup of tea.
I'm pounding the tea.
Have your lovely wife, Carmel, get up and get you some tea. I work with Carmel. That's how I can say this. Yeah, like fetch your slippers right out of... she'll get me tomorrow. She'll get me tomorrow. I am keeping under-the-weather Jim DeRogatis on the phone for another 20 minutes or so because I cannot... rave enough about his book Soulless, A Case Against R. Kelly. It is really a book about Chicago and journalism and crime and punishment. Jim writes in the book, Jim is not from here, but he writes, I had never loved a city, any city, as much as Chicago. I enjoyed living in Minneapolis twice, but it truly is a small town and one where some restaurants at the time thought egg noodles and ketchup were pasta. Chicago was special. Then he writes in that same page, through the mid, after extolling many things about Chicago, except for its pizza, he's New York all the way on that. Through the mid-90s, I continued to follow R. Kelly's burgeoning career with the pride of a hometown journalist and critic who'd been there almost at the start, as well as, I'll admit, a fan, albeit one with reservations. We flip forward a few years in Jim's life and career. He and Abdon Palish have been teamed together for what will eventually be 33, I think, 30-something byline stories together. Here's how it starts. After 4 weeks of 16-hour days, working through weekends and juggling the emotionally draining Kelly reporting with our regular assignments, Abdon and I felt exhausted but wired. We were frustrated by the angles we hadn't nailed, yet confident of a lead we'd spent more time crafting. A lead being the beginning of a story for you, the non-journalists out there. Lead we'd spent more time crafting under more scrutinizing eyes than the first paragraph of any other story either of us had ever written. Here is that lead as it appeared in the Sun-Times. Chicago singer and songwriter R. Kelly used his position of fame and influence as a pop superstar to meet girls as young as 15 and have sex with them, according to court records and interviews. Abdon and Jim then went down to the Billy Goat, a place that Jim incomprehensibly doesn't like as much as Abdon or I do. But
yes.
And you expected a different kind of reaction to that story than you got, did you not?
We would never have thought that 19 years later, this would be ongoing until the feds finally moved. You know, we thought we nailed him, Rick.
Yep, I know.
We had so much on the record and in court papers, information that had been sealed by courts but given to me. You know, I never thought I'd still be on this in the summer of 2017 when it turned out he was living with six women in what their relatives called a cult, that they were brainwashed. You know,
one of the great ironies, Jim, one of the great ironies in this, I don't remember if you brought it up in the book, that you know, he also, his apartment in Trump Tower, which is like 30-some floors above where you got that fax, the first fax. That haunts me forever. That's where the Sun-Times building was.
Where the Sun-Times was. That's where I watched the video.
Yeah.
Of him sexually assaulting, urinating in the mouth of a 14-year-old girl with that girl's aunt.
Yeah.
You know, he's pathological. He returns to the same places again and again and again. Kenwood Academy, the Rock and Roll McDonald's, where, you know, he got out of jail a couple of months ago on the Illinois charges, right, and went to the new green McDonald's that was the Rock and Roll McDonald's.
Yeah, I know. It's crazy.
You know, when he left home, he was staying at the Y in the South Loop, and he would busk on the streets, and then it was converted to luxury condos, and he bought the
penthouse. That was his first condo.
First home, yeah.
Yeah.
You know, it's a weird sort of pathology. You see this with, you know, not to be melodramatic, but you see it with, like, you know, Charles Manson and the Green River Killer.
Yep.
You know, there's these praying grounds. And, you know, none of this was secret in Chicago. And I got to say, cops on the beat knew this. They knew to watch for him at the Rock and Roll McDonald's at Evergreen Plaza in front of Kenwood. The investigation was already a year and a half or 2 years old when we did our first story in December 2000.
Yeah.
You know, there were a lot of people of conscience. The prosecutors, Shauna Bolliker, who's now on the bench, Bob Hagesheimer, who's retired, the investigators, Dan Everett and several others, they wanted to stop this. I think they lack an asset that we had as reporters. You know, there is a justifiable suspicion in the black community of law enforcement, and it was much less threatening talking to two reporters.
Absolutely.
Two unlikely white reporters,
yeah,
a fat white rock critic, and a little Irish Polish leprechaun, right, which is what Abden's.
Abden likes it when you call him that. That's
yes,
a great
he gets
thing.
A kick out of that. My editor was very concerned that he'd be offending it. It's like, no.
One of the most dramatic parts of the book for me, Jim, revolves around that VHS tape when. You know, you might have been arrested. Judge Gaughan, that horrible person, announced that I'd be arrested if I did not appear or form it before 10 in the morning that night. Sometimes music editor Tom Conner called my wife Carmel and told her she shouldn't answer the door at home for anyone. That was a real debate at the paper, was it not?
Oh, it was significant because Gaughan had thrown several people in jail for contempt of court.
Yeah.
A mentally disturbed woman who had, you know, shouted free R. Kelly. He threw her in jail. He threatened Kelly's crisis manager with jail for violating his gag order. And he was furious that the Sun-Times would not produce me. And the reason we wouldn't is it was going to put serious damage to the reporter's privilege, the Illinois shield law.
Absolutely, sure.
You know, and I was, you know, I was not going to name any of the people who had spoken to me in confidentiality for the best reason any whistleblower does. We now see it in the federal indictment that physical harm was threatened to them by Kelly's people. You know, then there was the highfalutin journalistic ethics of it. It's going to set bad precedent. And, you know, the deadline that every other paper that reported that day when I took the Fifth Amendment on the stand in Gaughan's courtroom, that I took the Fifth and cited the First Amendment, even though Gaughan was not recognizing that. The Tribune just reported I took the Fifth.
Yeah.
I succeeded in getting Anne-Marie Lipinski to run a correction.
I remember that.
Because I did that for every journalist in Chicago.
Of course.
You know, and Gaughan tried the same thing. He presided over the shooting trial of Laquan McDonald.
Yeah.
And he was upbraided that time by, you know, for sealing the records, gag orders, all this stuff, was upbraided by the Illinois Supreme Court for constitutionally unacceptable behavior. And, you know, it's high time that man is removed from the bench. And you know, he's been a stain on Chicago, and he's not the only one.
Yep.
The defense attorneys, you know, one of whom is Sam Adam Jr. You've been on 90 lately?
Oh, yeah, you said big billboards.
Huge billboards. Sam will fight for you. You know, his partner, Ed Jensen, the senior attorney on that team, they were all making $850 an hour for 6.5 years, gave an interview to Neil Steinberg of the Sun-Times just 2 months ago and said, we all knew Kelly was guilty as
hell. It was like the old lawyer. He's coming clean finally. Yeah.
How do you look at yourself in the mirror
when
you have babies and you have grandchildren and you know what he's done to these young black women and you know he's guilty? you know, and you game the system through bribery and intimidation of witnesses. Kelly's gaming the system. To what extent are those attorneys culpable? Yeah. To what extent was Judge Vincent Gaughan culpable?
Sure.
There were literally thousands of people in Chicago, from the lowly guy who ran the tape recorders at the studio to, you know, and the guy who would book his gym, his high-end court at the high-end gym, and to the managers, the accountants, the lawyers. You know, everybody turned a blind eye for 30 years because the first victim is 1991.
Well, fame and money. What your book reaffirmed for me is how fame combined with money combined with sociological troubles can really be a huge kind of blanket and an insulation. We got to take one more break and then I'll take you all the way to the top of the hour. I have a million questions about this book because I obviously admire tremendously Solis, A Case Against R. Kelly. I want to mention a couple of heroes. We've mentioned a couple of the terrible villains in here, but there are people aside from Jim and Abdon Palish who are heroic in this whole thing. Will be right back. There are many, many villains in the book Solis, A Case Against R. Kelly, minor and major. There are also great heroes. Jim DeRogatis doesn't like to be regarded as such, but he is. So is his colleague Abdon Palish. And so is, sort of forgotten in this whole thing, Mary Mitchell, who is African-American and who was one of your strongest allies, especially when you were confronted with not so much abuse, but troubles with the African-American community, wasn't she?
Yeah, when people were calling us racist,
yeah.
Mary wrote something like 36 columns in the first couple of years screaming at her community that there was a predator in its midst. And, you know, we were not two white guys trying to bring down a black superstar.
Right.
We were trying to stop this man preying on their daughters.
Yeah.
And, you know, but whether it was Jesse Jackson and the Operation Push people or
the Pitchfork, you know, people who put him on
the Pitchfork people.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, it was this willful ignoral of people being hurt.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, people keep wanting to ask me, are you aggrieved in any way that the six-hour docuseries Surviving R. Kelly, which aired in January,
right,
it took that to prompt action. And I tell you, Rick, this goes against every grain in my body and yours. Reporters do not like to be scooped.
Of course not.
But on this story, me, Abdon, Mary Mitchell, we never felt proprietary.
Of course not.
We kept thinking, everybody should be writing about this. Where is the Chicago Tribune? Where are the big out-of-town magazines? Where is Rolling Stone? Where is Billboard? Everybody should be writing
even
about this.
Where, you know, where is Frontline? Where's 2020? Where's, you know, the potent TV? Again,
well, I remember Dateline did an interview with Abdon and me, but they had gotten a Kelly interview.
Right.
So they were exceedingly slanted against
us. Of course.
And,
they got the big star. Again, Jim dedicates his book for the girls. Jim, I've got to believe this book might have been a hard sell to publishers.
Yeah.
As good as it is, and I think
you want to hear something
horrifying?
There were two people in all of publishing in New York who were interested. One is a woman named Amy Hundley, who works at Grove Atlantic, who went to Kenwood Academy with
Kelly. She has a personal connection to
personal
the story.
Connection yeah. to this horror, and she grew up reading me and listening to me. The other, Jameson Stoltz, grew up in Oak Park,
uh-huh.
went to Oak Park, River Forest High, where the girl in the video
right,
went.
Right.
He grew up reading and listening to me. That's it. That's who, all of who was interested. You know, now Jameson has edited Gay Talese
mm-hmm.
and Mark Bowden, you know, and he saw it as a work of literary journalism.
Let's I agree.
Try to tell a story that is bigger than this guy. And you know, that's the only thing that got me to live with this ugliness. And, you know, in a lot of ways, it's not over, I'm sure. You know, the horrible things that are going to come out.
I can't even imagine. That may be
in the trial, but he's never going to breathe fresh air again. So it really
good. So the bottom line is good. I also have to believe that people may start to think of this book like, ooh, God, R. Kelly. That is not what this book is about. This book is kind of a detective story. It is about so many other things. It is so also about Chicago and these sort of precarious way in which we, the races, live here. Yeah. I think it's like...
Well, and you know, and I think above and beyond that, you know, you got to remember, Rick, I'm a music critic.
Yeah,
and
I know.
Roger Ebert, a mutual friend of ours, a mentor, a colleague for 15 years sometimes, and Lester Bangs, those two paradigms for me of how much art means in the world and how important it is and how we have to confront it, you know, vehemently when it espouses false ideals, whether it's triumph of the will. I mean, this conversation I had with Roger about that Nazi propaganda film, or Lester, you know, believing in the core of his being, as I do, that music can save your life.
Sure.
Well, is there a flip side? Can it also be the ultimate tool to corrupt and ruin lives? And that's what we've seen with Kelly.
Obviously.
You know, I mean, we get to the very nature of, I got to sit the day the book was published in New York at a public radio thing with Tarana Burke, who launched hashtag MeToo in the Bronx in 2006. And it struck me, Rick, I am sitting with this woman. This must be what it would have been like to sit with Dr. King or Malcolm X in 1964.
Yeah.
In terms of the worldwide civil rights conversation and revolution she has started. And, you know, it's long overdue. It's the entire history of humanity overdue.
Oh, of course.
And boy, the fight has not been won. It wasn't, you know, it wasn't won when, you know, Anita Hill testified, and it wasn't won when Dr. Christine Blasey Ford testified. You know,
we
have someone in the White House who brags of grabbing them by
things.
The, you know,
yeah.
Right. No. You know, but it needs to be had, and what is left for people like you and me who care about music and art and literature is, can we separate the art and the artist? Should we? And I think 99% of the time we can, because, you know, there would be no art if we'd only accept art from perfect
people. From perfect people. There are no perfect people. I mean, you have
Woody Allen, you know, Michael Jackson, R. Kelly. You know, this is going to be a troublesome for decades to come.
No kidding. You have done, Jim DeRogatis, you know how much I admire your work, but this thing is really over the top. Soulless, The Case Against R. Kelly. I've read it twice. I will read it again one of these days because it is...
Well, I hope we get to sit one of these days, Rick, in a journalism symposium.
I'd love to, Jim.
You know, teaching at Columbia and seeing, you know, it was one of my students, Mina Bloom.
I know.
Who broke the alligator story.
I know. I should actually enroll in Columbia. I never went to college. I'd love to have you as a professor. Jim, it's a remarkable book. Please feel better. Please write another book, will you?
I'm going to write something much more fun next time, yes.
I can't imagine what kind of toll this was to live with it and to write it, and you could not. I would not change a word in this book. Soulless,
well, thank you,
Case
Rick.
Against R. Kelly by Jim DeRogatis. It's remarkable work, and it should be on the shelf of anybody who cares about Chicago. And it's also incredibly readable, even though there, you know, there's some icky stuff in it, as they say. Life can be icky. Jim, sweet dreams.
Thank you, Rick. We'll talk soon.
Take care.
Bye.
It's quite a book. Thank you so much for listening to this show. Roel Coleman, thanks for producing. Dan, thanks for engineering.